Hey, gang, we would like to wish a happy 5th anniversary to our friends over at Strange Brew Loungeside, winner of so many Austin Music Awards, including Best Venue. Best Venue for the last couple years in a row. Come out and join the celebration if you're in Austin this Sunday, June 14th, 2015, from 1 to 8 p.m., featuring the music of Renfro, Apostles of Manchaca, and more. Go to StrangeBrewLoungeside.com to find out more details. Congratulations and thank you to Strange Brew Loungeside for the great room to play and for all the fantastic shows over the last 5 years. You guys are amazing, all right? Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself,
how did I get here? And now here is your host, Tom Howdy.
All right. Hello, I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I have a fantastic show for you today. I have my very dear old friend and bandmate for the last like 14 years or 13 years, Darren Murphy. Great guy. We are in Skyrocket together. I knew him in Houston. I met him back in 1988. I started playing with this guy named Cliff, who was the sound guy for the band that Darren played in, which was Ezra Charles and The Works. I was a young guy. Darren was a young guy. And we met and became friends. I got to know him over the years after he moved to Austin. I played with him in his band. And it's interesting doing these things. You know, like I make friends with strangers. People I don't know that come on the show, I end up having relationships with them and friendships, going to dinner with them, going to lunch with them, going to see a band with them, going to grabbing a drink with them. And then people that I do know, that I know very well, that I see a few times a week, that I spend hours with a week. I mean, hours. We spend a lot of time together, Darren and I, and all the gang in Skyrocket, in a great way. You think, when you're me, you're like, I'm going to get this guy on the show. What am I even going to talk about? But then, as you're thinking about it, when he's coming over, you're like, you know what? There's a lot of stuff. There's like the cracks. Like you've seen a lot of stuff happen, but you didn't ask details about what was going on in his mind while that happened. You know, different events. So it's interesting. I got to know Darren even better than I do know him through our 4 mile walk around Town Lake here in Austin. So Darren came over. We had shorts on. We had walking shoes on, and we went for a walk around the lake, and I just kind of started asking him questions about his incredible musicianship and where he got his finely tuned ear. So that happens. Stay tuned for that. It's a great conversation. Interestingly enough, Skyrocket is off this weekend, and Darren and I have tickets to a movie tonight. We're going to go see Love and Mercy, that Brian Wilson starring Paul Dano and John Cusack. I'm excited about it. Darren saw it the other day. I tried to make it to go see him, but some stuff exploded, and I didn't get to make it. So I'm excited. We'll see this movie tonight. Once again, hanging out. So no Skyrocket gigs this weekend. No gigs at all. I'm hanging out, freestyling. I'm probably going to do some stuff with Zuri. Maybe go see some music. I've got some things in mind to do. I've got to book some more podcast shows. Things are going nuts. I've spent the week practicing with Amy Edwards. We got together a few times this week, and I'm playing guitar with her on July 3rd, and I'm pretty excited about that. You might remember her. She was on a couple months back on the show. Very great music, and it's been a good time. I've been practicing over with her and Yates, the drummer and kind of music director, and it's been a really good time. It's been a lot of fun playing electric guitar and being kind of noisy and crazy. I don't get to do that all the time anymore, and so that's been a lot of fun getting back into that. So anyway, look, I hope all of you have a great weekend. That ding. Maybe it's time for me to stop talking. I hope all of you have a great weekend, and I hope you enjoy taking a walk, a 4 mile walk, with Darren and I around Town Lake in Austin, Texas. So please, without further ado, one of my best friends and my bandmate in Skyrocket, the great Darren Murphy. Let's get down.
Travel, the good way to travel, the natural.
How did you do Solitarium? Because I was listening to both of those today, and Solitarium, to me, when it came out, I was so used to your four-track demos of those same songs that it blew my mind sonically, because I was like, oh man, he ruined those great songs with all this high fidelity. And then today, I didn't see that huge of a step into Haunted Gardenias, but Haunted Gardenias is a little bigger sounding and broader sounding. How did you do Solitarium?
Solitarium was all done on D88 machines.
Oh, okay.
DA88 machines. And I went over, and you remember Daryl Klingman from Houston. And he just called me up one afternoon and said, hey, let's make a record. And no one had ever said that to me before.
Right.
And so I said, okay. And I, at that point, I didn't really know anything about how to get good drum sounds. I just took my drum kit in there, tuned it as best I could. And so we did some tunes there, and I wasn't terribly satisfied with any of it sonically. We ended up using quite a few of those tracks on the album, but I really had to work the drums to get them to sound decent. And so I went and did the rest of the album in Austin at Top Hat Studios when it was still open downtown.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a much better place to record. And that was when I hooked up with Lars. Lars really helped me finish that album. And then
Lars have his own place then? Place that was over kind of by Tequila, by that Starbucks?
No. He was not there yet. He wasn't doing much stuff out of his house at the time.
Okay.
He was just working at other studios, and working at that place that's, I think it's a coffee joint now, so over at the 501 production block.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What was that called? Music Lane.
Music Lane, yeah. So we actually did some tracks for Haunted Gardenias at Music Lane.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did drums and guitars for, was it Metro B?
Mm-hmm.
And one or two others. I think Blackberry Plane.
Did Solitarium, that was just you playing everything?
Yeah, that was
and
me.
And then Haunted Gardenias, did you have other people come in?
Yeah. I did. I did all of the drums and some of the basic guitar work, but then I'd have some people, guys from the real heroes like Paul English and Kenneth Dowling, and then I had some folks like Brian Standifer came in and played some cello.
Oh, right.
Noah Litt played some slide guitar. John Sanchez played some really cool guitar. Derek Morris did some keys.
Oh, yeah, I was wondering who's playing. There's a Wurlitzer on one of the songs. I can't remember right now. It's pretty badass.
And then there was another fellow. I was playing in a band called The Love Supreme at the time. And so the keyboardist for The Love Supreme came in and laid down some keys as well. Trish Murphy came in. Did some singing.
So, Darren, man, this is a burning question. And you hear music kind of differently than other people that I know, and definitely differently than me. And to me, it always seems like when you hear music, you're almost walking into like a 3D hologram of what's happening sonically in the song, and you can kind of walk up to things and pull them out and hear them exclusively, independently of the whole recording. Which to me, it always blows my mind when you can do that. Like, you just walk outside with your fucking phone and come back with a four-part harmony that you just heard on the thing. And have you always been like that? Because I'm wondering, is this a God-given thing, or did you really work that hard to be able to do this?
I think it's a gift, honestly.
Yeah,
But I was aware of it when I was very, very young. When I was 4 or 5 years old, my parents had one of those stereo consoles that not a lot of folks on the block had, and stereo was pretty new at the time. And I remember just sitting there with my ears pressed against the speaker, whatever speaker there was, but my ears pressed against it, just playing these songs over and over and over again, and studying them and listening just really intently to everything that was going on. And sometimes I would imagine myself not as a member of the band in the cutting room, but as the producer in the control room.
That's awesome.
Listening to it going on and giving him the thumbs up.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
That was always, and it was I just had an insatiable appetite for that sort of thing. Any kind of music that was happening, I just listened to it and dissect it and digest it.
So your parents obviously were the same sort of in my mom's generation and kind of going through that hippie thing where they still listen to rock and roll and like we're going to raise their kids to go see bands and do the whole thing. Like you grew up that same way too.
Yeah.
You were in fact at one of the same shows that we know of.
That's right.
Yeah. So how much of their influence on you and that did you take? How much did you go on your own? Or get on your own, you know what I mean? Like, I got the Beatles and Dylan and the Birds and all the cool bands from my mom, but like, I had to get Captain and Tennille on my own.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had to discover The Who on my own, because we didn't have any Who records at the house. But, you know, we had, you know, my dad was all about the raw R&B. He was all about the Jimmy Reed. And Bob Dylan was into Jimmy Reed, so he was into Dylan. And CCR was into Jimmy Reed, so he was into CCR.
Okay.
And my mother loved the Brown Eyed Handsome Man. She loved Wilson Pickett, John Barry, Otis. Yeah. So we had all that. And other stuff, quirkier stuff I had to discover on my own, like, you know, The Police and Rush. I didn't know anyone who was into punk rock at the time, so it took me a long time before I discovered that. My sister, my oldest sister Gina, brought home Elton John.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And she was going to all of the concerts. She was going out on the high school dates, going to see Aerosmith and Ted Nugent. And so I got exposure to a lot of that through my oldest sister Gina. Yeah.
And so how did that, did you then trickle down to Trish? Did you turn her on to music? Was it like a little train? Like Gina was a little older, so she would find stuff and bring it to you guys?
And Trish was a little older than me.
Oh, sorry. She's a little older.
Yeah, but she was into much more sophisticated esoteric music. She was into, you know, Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou Harris and Joni Mitchell.
Right.
So I ended up soaking up a lot of that through them. And then, you know, Trish went to college before I did, and she was turned on to a whole bunch of other different music and sent it down to me. So it was all just trickle down to me.
Right.
And then occasionally I'd find something that I could, you know, that I could whack back up at them.
Right, right.
But my stuff, most of the music I was into was so obnoxious that it just wasn't worth it.
Right. What was it?
Yeah. Well, I was into Rush, you know, and women aren't into Rush.
No, they're not. That's such a strange phenomenon.
Yeah.
So when you were young, your dad played, right?
Yes.
And he was playing out from the time you were born? Like,
More or less,
He had a guitar around the house and he would play, and he got you guys singing early on.
He did. He got us all singing, and he played when he was in college. Yeah. And he got to know all these people from the scene that later became legends. People like Kenny Rogers and Mickey Newberry and BJ Thomas.
Yeah.
You know, he hung out with all those guys. So, obviously, he was very influenced by all of them, and he became a really good songwriter and getting his own band together. So there was always music happening in the house, whether it was performed live. If it wasn't live, there were records constantly.
Right.
And he was a great actor, too. So everything that Trish and I do, we do because our dad did it.
Yeah. You kind of learned from him. And he did something else, though, for a living, though, right? He was in oil, am I right?
He was in construction.
Construction.
And it started out as just something he had to do to
support the family.
Right, to get the bills paid. And so he was out seriously blue-collar stuff, out surveying and places that would become affluent Houston suburbs.
Oh, right.
And I went out to work with him a couple of times. Yeah, with my little cowboy boots, you know, hanging out in the mud and looking at water moccasins.
Right.
scary time. I remember him actually putting me in the station wagon when I was more than 5 years old, and just handing me the steering wheel. So, I was like, they're steering this big-ass station wagon about 50 times my size.
That's a funny thing. Do you ever think about, like, I mean, I don't know if it happened with you, and I'm not incriminating anybody in my family, but I know that people would go on a beer run, like, on a motorcycle and take me with them, like, on the back of it.
Yep.
Like, when we were kids. And there's, as a dad now, it's a different, like, you don't let Dexter ride around in the back of a truck when you're hauling ass through the country, you know,
no.
or mudding or anything like that, like people would do when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
Are you cognizant of that, or do you ever go like, man, throw him in the back of the truck, let's see.
Oh yeah, and I almost got divorced because of that.
Well, so in that time when you were a kid and you were seeing your dad, but did you ask, like, hey, teach me how to play guitar, or was he like, you're going to learn how to play guitar?
He never pushed that stuff on
never
us.
Did?
No, he always corralled us around and got us to sing.
Right.
Because he knew that we all enjoyed it, and it was a serious bonding ritual.
Yeah.
Very early on. It held us together for a long time, even in the toughest times. That was what we had to hold on to.
Right.
But I was interested in drums.
Oh.
Early on. Yeah. Because I could hear that something about that resonated with me, and the pictures of just the picture of Ringo Starr playing the drums
yeah.
was just so captivating.
Yeah, there's pictures that I have from when I was a kid where even before I knew what I wanted to do, I was like, I bet that guy's got it going, like the T-Rex record where you stand, I'm drawing a blank on the name of it. Electric Warrior, like
oh,
that
yeah,
record, like you look at that, you're like, Jesus, man.
That's iconic.
That's something I would like to stand right there.
That little,
just like that.
Little coiled guitar
yeah.
cable.
Yeah, giant amp, like rock and roll. So drummers inspired you, and then when did you get a drum kit?
I didn't actually get a full kit until my 11th birthday. My people would donate things. You know, I had a snare drum when I was 9 or 10.
Sure.
A friend came by with a pair of trashy hi-hats that I just turned into cymbals.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, a kick drum appeared without a pedal. And I just used that to put a tom on, you know.
Right.
So, my 11th birthday, I get this full drum kit, you know, four-piece. I just kind of strung everything together and tied it up and tried to make out whatever it was I could.
Right.
And it was all, I did it all on my own. Once in a while, somebody would come over and give me a tip. Because my dad knew a lot of musicians.
Right.
He knew a lot of guitar players.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Clarence Gatemouth Brown came over and jammed with us.
That's unbelievable.
And I'm still, God rest his soul, he is my
yeah.
Ravi Shankar.
Yeah.
I will never, ever be good enough to be in his band at any instrument.
But yet you got to jam with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you were a kid.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. Did he encourage you? I mean, do you remember those? Like, I remember being with guys that were older musicians who teach me a new chord or something, or teach me Sympathy for the Devil on guitar, like one of my mom's friends, and then you just never forget them. And you're
right.
Like, oh, yeah, that's my guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he never really, I mean, I think he would tell me things like, you just got to lay it down.
Right.
You know. And that's like the number one lesson that every single drummer in the world needs to know. And they need to hear it early and often.
Right.
You've got to lay it down.
Yeah. You're the guy.
Yeah.
I bet that's some of the reason why, because your presence, not only as the drummer, but your presence as the drummer in Skyrocket, the look of panic on Trish and Ben's faces when you were like, hey, I'll get a sub. You know he's good. They're like, wait, is he going to lay it down? Like, that's the question.
Right.
Yeah. So did you, you got your full drum kit. Did you take lessons, or did you just figure that shit out on your own?
Never took lessons. I figured it out on my own, and I got good to a certain point, and I picked up a lot of bad habits, and I didn't discover these bad habits until I was deep in it playing professionally, and so it wasn't until about maybe 20 years ago. When I got into a real band, that was when I got into the studio and discovered that I couldn't play in the studio. And
20 years ago?
Yeah, yeah.
That's weird because we became very close friends at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. There was to me, you were almost like the most professional guy I knew, even up there with like Grissom and people like that. Were you? That's strange to hear.
Well, but, you know, after Trish and I, I'm jumping like way ahead.
Right.
But after Trish and I had our band together, and I had been fronting a band for 4 years or whatever
right.
on guitar, I immediately went back to drumming, and I joined Jesse Dayton's band.
Right.
He had just this little three-piece country rock combo. I had no business being in that band. I didn't know how to play the right grooves. I didn't look the part. And when you're in a place where you really don't belong, it screws with your head and it makes you crazy. So I was just stupid. And
so instead of thinking like, oh, I belong somewhere else, you're thinking like, I am the worst drummer in the world.
Oh.
What am I doing here?
Yeah. I mean, the great part of it was I got to meet Kenny Aronoff, because he was brought in to play on the tracks because I couldn't cut it.
Well, at least it was him and not somebody that you hang out with, you know, with Nautics.
Right. But I found myself just totally landing flat on my ass.
How?
And I was like, how did I get here?
Yeah, how did that happen? That's fascinating. I never even knew that.
I just was not prepared. I didn't know the rules. I didn't know the code. And I was just me, used to being me and my ego. You know, bopping around the town. And so it did not fit in that scenario. And it exposed so many musical and business shortcomings that I had to literally start over.
Huh.
So I started over on drums. I went back to the very basic rudiments. And that allowed me... You know, I got a day job.
Right.
It allowed me to reassess everything about the way I play. My positioning, my grip, the position of each drum. And I rebuilt my groove from the very bottom. And I discovered so much about myself in the process. I discovered how primal drumming was to
yeah.
my nature and also to my personality, and how my maturity on drums went hand in hand with my maturity as a human being.
Wow. Jesus.
Yeah, it was very, very deep and spiritual and soul-searching and meditative. But I came out much stronger afterwards. You know, after you've just ripped your ego out and sent it down the river, you have to rebuild, and it is scary.
Yeah.
But I knew there was something I had to do if I wanted to really have a career.
Right.
In any capacity.
Right. So, wait, let's go back to the high school times. This is like Behind the Music, when they show something that happens in the future, and then Darren didn't believe in himself. did you start a band? Like, you were 11 when you got a full kit. Did you have a band? Did you join a band? Did you start a band? Did you just play until...
No, I just played. I played with the family and all the adults.
Okay.
Because I didn't have friend number one that was even into listening to music, let alone playing it.
Huh.
And so it wasn't until I made friends with, you know, one of my lifelong pals, a guy named Scott Smith, who lives in New Jersey now. He started playing guitar.
Okay.
So that actually got me more into playing guitar. That inspired me, because my dad and Trish both played, but I didn't. And at some point, I couldn't stand not being able to play guitar anymore. So I picked it up and never put it down. But the first thing resembling a group was a little singing trio I had with a couple of friends in junior high. You know, just picking out three-part Beatles songs like Nowhere Man and
yeah.
Please Please Me.
So that's where that ability comes from. You hone that doing, like, being able to pick apart harmonies and things like that.
Right.
All right. How old were you then? Like 12, 13?
I was 14.
14?
Yeah.
That's awesome. And you had no formal musical training.
No.
You were just in it. Like, you could hear it differently than other people.
We were all just winging it by ear.
Yeah.
And I would frustrate my dad because he'd start a song and he'd be in a different key. And I'd say, like, no, it's not that chord, Dad. He's like, shut up!
That's insane. So then what was your trajectory then? You got out of high school and you DJ'd.
I did, yeah.
What okay, so you, where did you graduate high school?
I graduated from HSPVA
right
in Houston. And I wasn't in a band then either. I had friends that I jammed with.
Were you in music there?
I was in theater.
In theater, okay.
Yeah. I got in as an actor because I knew that having no formal training as a musician, I was not going to be able to go in and audition in the
music
department.
Yeah, I didn't make my audition there because of that.
Right. So I made it as a stage actor doing Shakespeare. And once I got out of high school and I started DJing in nightclubs, and I got a much more expansive knowledge of not only of modern music,
right,
but of older music from my dad's generation as well. So that was really, really healthy thing to do. And of all the cocaine that was flying around 24/7 in the club, is not a speck of it made its way into my system. I have no idea how.
But, so you just must have been annoyed though by the end of the night with everyone like, you know what I mean?
It was kind of annoying. And I was thinking to myself, my gosh, as obnoxious as I am sober, I can't imagine myself wired. Forget it.
Yeah. So, but you weren't playing.
I wasn't playing, no. I was. I met a guy named Carl Trollinger in college at U of H. And he was into the same music I was into, and was a shredder of a guitar player. So he and I started jamming together. And then one day he brought over Mike Belial.
Right.
And we formed a trio called Manic Pop Thrill. That was my first band.
Wow.
And that was my first attempt to go out and get real gigs.
Right. What were you studying at U of H real fast?
I was studying media. I was studying RTF, but I was taking acting classes.
Right.
But my DJ thing started taking off, and I started getting transferred out of town. So I was just sort of, I left college and never looked back.
I'm trying to think of what your life was like. Like, you worked what, like you went in at like 8 or 9?
Yeah.
At night?
Sometimes I'd go in at 4:30 or 5, just depending on what the shift was. And and then if I'd come in at late night, we would, I'd just be spinning records for 5 or 6 hours right up until closing time, and pack up, go, you know, get a late night bite. It's kind of boring, really.
Yeah, did you spend your, because it's lonely. I mean, it's not, especially, like, didn't you go to, like, Fort Lauderdale and stuff?
Yeah, spent a year in Fort Lauderdale.
But, I mean, did 20. You know anyone when you moved there?
No.
Yeah, I mean...
No, I knew one guy that I had met briefly...
And you're like the one guy in the club not doing coke, so how are you going to make friends?
Right. So this one guy that I'd met briefly while training in Tampa became my roommate in Fort Lauderdale. And so we became close friends, and we had the same schedule because we were both DJs.
Right.
And so that was... And that was boring, too.
Right. But during the day, were you playing? Like, were you, like, you know, in your living room, like, sitting down, picking out songs? And
I'd be playing my guitar.
Right.
Yeah. But I wasn't writing anything back then.
Okay.
I had no idea how to write songs, and, you know, no really interest. I was just living kind of a shallow existence. I think we were 20 years old.
Yeah.
You're living on your own for the first time. You can't see or hear anything except women.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in Fort Lauderdale during spring break? Are you kidding?
Yeah, I can't believe that. That sounds insane. That's another podcast unto itself. So when you started Manic Pop Thrill, you guys, I can't remember if you opened for Sprawl at Zelda's or if I saw you like in the same week that I saw Sprawl at Zelda's. But I remember seeing, and I think I'm right on this, it was like October or November of 1987.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
We were doing gigs at... I remember playing gigs at Fitzgerald's opening for bands like The Missiles and Cold Blue Steel. And then playing at Zelda's and opening for... I want to say we were on a bill with Stick People once. And then
maybe that's where I saw you.
May have been. And we were... We weren't bad. We could get a good groove going, but we were all still just... trying to learn how to write songs, and I was trying to learn how to be a performer.
Yeah.
And I was ostensibly just pretending to be a performer at that time. But you know, I sang the right parts, but I wore all the wrong clothes.
Right. What about, well, you know, that's weird because I just remember walking away going like, okay, that's it. I'm pretty sure it was that band too, because I don't know why I remember it. But I think I remember it because at that time I was trying to find what I was going to be doing musically. And I think what you guys were doing resonated with me, and I was like, oh, I understand what they're doing. You know what I mean? It wasn't like alt country or what, new sincerity, and it wasn't like the funk movement that was going on then too, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it was
like
just
Sprawl and all that stuff. It was like guitar pop music.
Exactly. It was post-punk power pop.
Yeah.
And we were covering things that, whatever it was we were into at the time, the Smithereens, that was kind of our template.
Right.
Yeah, and Phantom Rocker and Slick, those guys. And we just took that as far as we could take it. And right at about the time that band was starting to unravel, Ezra Charles came to see me. And I'd seen him several times and gotten to know his band really well.
Right.
Because he played at a club I was DJing at, and he took me to breakfast one night and asked me to join the band on drum. And that was my first ever full-time professional gig. I was going to cut my salary in half and do nothing but play drums.
So how exciting was that for you?
It was incredible. It was a life changer. I jumped on that.
They were a professional working band at the time, because I remember that. I remember talking to Cliff about it, because your sound guy ended up being the keyboard player in my band.
That's right. You guys were in Panjandrums
right
together.
And I just remember then, because I was like 20, like, okay, because I only knew people in Austin that made a living playing music. Everyone else had a job like in Houston. And then all of a sudden I started like, oh, okay, here are these guys. You know, they have an idea of what's going on. You know, with Ezra Charles and the Works, like, those guys are pros. Like, this is what they do.
Ezra is the hardest working man in show business. He has always just worked so hard at administrative stuff, at technical stuff, physical stuff. I've never seen anyone that worked as hard as Ezra did to keep that band together. You know, he recently retired just last year.
No.
But he's still playing. Right. He just retired the Works.
Right.
Yeah.
So how much did... Hey, let me ask you a question. How come doing that gig, coming in out of not even really playing in bands, how did you not have your come to Jesus moment that you had later on with Jesse Dayton? How come you didn't have that with Ezra?
Probably because we weren't recording very much.
And
I had a much better chemistry with Ezra. Ezra had we had a good friendship. Ezra had a solid appreciation for what I was doing. I got to really gel with the other people in his band. It was a good fit.
Yeah.
And the other one wasn't. So, you know, that's just how it is.
Right.
And I would hear I think we recorded maybe one track together. And I was like, yeah, it's okay. But at that point, I didn't know what was good and what was bad.
Right.
And at about the same time that I was doing that, Trish moved back into town. She had just been living in Rome, Italy, and in Los Angeles.
Right.
And she moved back to Houston, and we immediately started playing acoustic guitar together. And next thing you know, we were writing songs together. And we had developed this really nice following as a brother and sister duo. We were Houston's own Tenacious D.
Yeah, yes. But much cuter. That was a sensation unto itself. I mean, you guys had a weekly show with the Ginger Man.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going to that a few times. I remember seeing you guys at the Pig, right?
Yeah, the Pig Live. We played the Satellite Lounge. We played the Rockefellers. We were playing five nights a week. Wherever we could play.
What do you think was the magic of that? Because there was magic. People used to go, it was a scene, are you going to see Trish and Darren? Like, that's something you could say to someone in Houston at that time, and they knew what you were talking about.
Right.
You know, maybe not my grandma, but most people our age.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a legitimate sort of scene. And it wasn't even like a dumb scene, because there was like all that heavy metal stuff going on. It was like... There were college kids at your shows.
Right. There were people, regulars at Lola's were coming to see our gigs.
Yeah.
I just think it's an undeniable chemistry that Trish and I had together.
Still do.
Yeah, still do.
Yeah.
And it was really great for that time in a, it was sort of a, music was on a holding pattern then, and anything went.
Yeah.
And then a year later, when grunge hit, the whole scene became so much more defined. Lines were drawn, and people were either on one side or to the other. So, like, you know, like anything happens, especially in Houston, there's always a backlash to something, you know, good that's, or fun or happy that's happening or whatever, you know.
Right.
So
there was too much sunshine in here.
Right. And we knew that it was, that we had it so good. We had it really easy. And, of course, it got challenging like it does.
Yeah.
And we got better. We started writing better songs and writing better records. But our individual styles started emerging.
Right.
And I really felt that we had gotten as far as we could as a duo, that we would make even bigger strides on our own. Because I really believed in what Trish was able to do. I believed in the kind of songs that I was wanting to write.
Right.
And Trish had a really good run of it. She went up, did a couple of Little Affair tours, released several albums. She wrote more songs than I did. I was, my attention was sort of being pulled from, you know, from one place to the other.
Well, there was also, like, you got to also make a living. I remember at that point, it did become, like, I remember after Mr. Rocket Baby, it was not as easy to make a living just out there touring, like a band. Or maybe we got older and needed more stuff, required a, you know.
Yeah, because once your lifestyle gets more complex and you start thinking more about your future.
Right.
After a while, it gets boring living from gig to gig, and you're trying to build a life for yourself at the same time. You're trying to nurture relationships with people.
Right.
And I got married right about the same time that I started making my first album.
You moved here. What was the decision to move here? I mean, obviously there was a lot more going on here than there was in Houston at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And here, maybe you could get a start without Trish and Darren over you. Is that part of it too?
Well, I hadn't really thought about that. I just thought there are tons of bands that operate while their members are living in different cities. Why not me? I love this town.
Right.
I have a fascination with it, and my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, was moving there. And this is funny, but what really sealed the deal for me was I went to a Houston Rockets game with my father-in-law, and I watched him blow a 20-point lead in the fourth period and in the middle of the playoffs. And I went home and said, let's go to Austin. Screw this town. We're out of here. Now, joke was on me because they won the championship that year.
Right. That was 94,
They redeemed. They became Clutch City.
Yeah. I remember doing a show with you and Trish when I was in Mr. Rocket Baby. Were you guys booked by Paul Nugent?
No.
Were you guys part of that whole...
That doesn't sound familiar to me. We were booked by Chris Smith for a while, who was running...
Yeah.
He was booking Fitzgerald's.
Yeah.
And he did that for us for a while. Trish's husband, Charlie Neath, started doing some stuff for us. And then he ran all of Trish's stuff.
Right.
After we split...
I remember that. I remember he used to talk a lot with my manager at the time, during that time, and so I would end up at lunches with them, just tagging along with Charlie and Martin.
Oh, yeah.
Because he used to go talk to Martin a lot.
Right.
So then you got here, you had obviously a musical vision that you had started on 4-track, which at the time there were so many people, to me in my world, everyone... was doing all these things on 4-track, and it kind of became like such a sound, you know. Everyone had their 4-track at their house, and
yeah,
you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. My 4-track was my best friend in the world
that
moment, and I was just taking all of this self therapy that I was doing, and processing that into, just converting that into songs.
And also there is something about one of those starting over points where you don't have a band, you don't have expectations, you just sit down with like a blank slate after you've already created a bunch of stuff and you have a reputation for something, and you kind of go like, all right, where do I go now?
Right.
And to me, that music's always really exciting. Like, there's something about 15 minutes, no matter how great Boxing Day is compositionally compared to it, there's something exciting about 15 minutes to me. Maybe because I was there, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of that group of songs, I Only Want to Make You Happy and stuff like that.
That's true. In fact, a good friend of mine named Dave Reyes is... just finished shooting a film, his first feature film that he's written and directed, called Trippin' to the Altar. And he chose 15 minutes to put in that movie because he's just always liked it.
Yeah. Well, there's something about not even just the recorded energy, just you can hear the excitement in somebody who has it, just the road's just totally open. And there were no rules. You didn't have to abide by anything. You were just making music in your room by yourself. You know what I mean? And there's just something to me, when somebody's really good and has something to say, the music that they make at that point has a little weight to it.
Yeah.
You know?
My vision was I wanted something like the first Foo Fighters album.
Right.
I'd heard that, and that was my biggest inspiration. I wanted to be like Dave Grohl.
Yeah. That was a very inspiring album to me as well. It was done in that same kind of spirit, too. Mm-hmm. He was just making, so he didn't even know if he was going to put something out. He was just making music with no rules.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there is something exciting to that record that isn't on their other records to me.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And he had much better recording gear than me.
But yeah.
But at that time, at the time I was writing all those songs and just four-tracking constantly, I was also teaching myself how to produce.
Yeah.
And that's how the Fab Forgeries came around.
Yeah, explain those, because those people can find it, Darren Music, under the music section, if you're listening.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And it's something I'd always toyed around with. When I got my first tape recorder, I was going to see how well I could build a Beatles song from the ground up, just to, as nothing else but an experiment.
Right.
Yeah, and an education. Just to see how, test my musicianship, my recording skills, all that stuff. And then I started going around playing it for people, and they started playing it for other folks.
Yes.
And I had no idea that some 10 years later, that was going to plant me in New York City, in the middle of it.
It's funny what just you do out of, it seems frivolous at the time, but it's your audition tape for Broadway.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm going to see if I can do these Beatles songs on my four track by myself. Fast forward 6 years, you're on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
So, man, I was going to ask you something about...
Solitarium, 15 minutes, four track.
Yes, when you did those Beatle tracks, I can't remember who it was, but I remember somebody at my house one day hanging out and going like, hey, Will told me you got this guy's Beatle recordings? And I was like, yeah. And that's when I knew it was like a thing in town. Like, it was like this underground thing that people were like, you can hear that guy's recordings, man? They're crazy. And I remember when you played the first one for me, might have been All My Loving.
Might have been one of those, yeah. Yeah, it's probably that or Help.
When I first heard it, you had so many bootleg Beatle things at that time that you'd always play me. That was kind of like, what's different about this one? This is just like the Beatles. I mean, this is what's different than this? You were like, oh, this is me. So, how those things you... Hold on.
Well, that was my calling card for a long time. That stuff and my original stuff. Since I didn't have a band, I didn't really know anyone. I would make myself go out to the scene, go out to wherever it was, the Steamboat or the Electric Lounge,
right?
Wherever it was happening, where I saw musicians that that I was interested in, and I would pass these tapes out.
Yeah,
they didn't know me from Adam. After a while, my phone started ringing. You know, my dear friend Robert Harrison called me up and said, hey, man, I love your drumming. I want you to come and play in these Cotton Mather tracks that I've got. And I'm like, well, that's a bucket list item right there.
You know, yeah, I love that. And you just recorded with them recently too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Last week.
Mm-hmm.
Those scenes were segregated at the time so strangely. I always felt like I should have been playing somewhere else, but I was given so much room to do what I wanted to at Steamboat that I kind of felt like I would rather do my own thing than worry about being... Because I'd done some shows at Electric Lounge, and it was just a different... There just wasn't as much freedom to kind of like, oh, I'm going to do this time. You know
right.
what I mean?
Because bands generally didn't get 2 hours to play at the Electric Lounge. They got maybe 50 minutes at the most, because there'd always be 3 or 4 bands on the bill.
Yeah.
So, the Steamboat was definitely a place where you could stretch out. And I only got to play there once or twice. Steamboat was actually, there weren't very few... very few booking agents that were into my stuff at the time. I had to bring a battery ram with me. I'd be drunk dialing bookers. Come on, you're booking all these people. You should be booking me.
The thing is like the feel of your music and the structure of your music and the way that you were getting it across just was not really what was going on at the time. I think that some of the same thing was happening with me, that some of that same stuff was happening with Britt.
Right.
Definitely like with Tony and Miles as well.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And of course, Cotton Mather, because, you know, in all honesty, here's this band that is revered so critically, has fans all over the world, but like in Austin, it's not as known.
Right. Right, because Austin... they really call it a Rolling Stones town versus a Beatles town. Because it experiments with several different styles but crawls back into the bed with the same 3 chords at the end of the day.
That's a great description. I mean, now it's changed so
that
much.
Mindy LaBurnes gets credit for
that's
that.
That's great.
To me, it really is a Hendrix town.
Yeah,
more than anything else. You know, I even asked some young kids, was like, "Hey, what do you think about Day Tripper?" And they're like, "Oh, well, the Jimi Hendrix version is awesome." Okay, so there you go.
That's funny. When did you start teaching? Back then, around Solitarium or after Solitarium?
No, actually, that was when I came back from New York.
Okay. So you did a show opening for Marshall Crenshaw, right? Or no?
Yeah, I did a couple of shows with Marshall. Okay. Yeah,
and then you met his manager.
I actually already knew his booking agent.
Okay,
this guy named Jeffrey Osborne.
Okay,
that lives here in Austin, and I had had a chance to hang out with Marshall a little bit, and so I ran into Jeffrey on the street one afternoon. And I said, "Hey, how's Marshall doing?" And he said, "Oh, he's doing good. Some guy is calling me from New York about putting him in this John Lennon musical, Broadway." I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, I want to do that. I can do that." He said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah. You know what you need to do? You need to go to my website and download the Fab Forgeries."
Yeah.
And as soon as he did that, he called me and said, "I'm sending your stuff to the director in New York." I was like, "Wow. Thank you. Anything else I can do? Some creative lobbying that we can do?"
Yeah.
It's like, this is the one thing like I know I can do better than anybody else. So, a couple weeks went by. Then I got a call from Don Scardino, the director.
The Don Scardino.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's directed all kinds of stuff. He's worked with Steve Carell and Jim Carrey. He's got a new series coming out this fall on CBS.
Did a lot of 30 Rock, but like most notably for me is he's part of that whole crew from Godspell in Toronto. You know what I mean?
Oh,
to me,
yeah.
That's the magic part of that dude. Like Gilda Radner, like everyone that had to do with that. Paul Schaefer.
Oh, he told us some Godspell stories.
I bet.
I'll tell you, I can't share them with you.
No. So you auditioned and you got the gig. In a sense.
Yeah, I got as good as anyone from my standpoint could have done, because you've got this massive crew of production people that are used to working with seasoned Broadway actors, and there's millions of dollars on the line. So they're not going to hire Joe Schmo out of Austin to take the lead. So they offered me a job as the swing. And my, you know, Don said to me, I'm telling you, I'd advise you not to take this because it's a lot of work for not a lot of gratification. I'd say, you know, hold out because the show is a hit. We'll be casting other people. You can get on then.
Instead of a swing part, you'd get another part, an actual.
Right.
Okay.
But I said, no, I need to do this. I really need to go in and be a part of this.
Yeah, you'd be a little more ready.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was a boot camp experience for me, and it was an opportunity to do something we've never done, to create a future for my family that we'd never seen.
Right.
So
you just had a son.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said I'm gonna roll the dice and go up and do this, and it was the best thing I ever did. Went up and stayed in the background for a long time, but I knew enough about the subject matter that people could come to me with questions and get the right answers. If they had musical questions, they'd say, hey, how does this go? Is it this chord? Is it that chord?
Yeah.
This hook here? And I'd be able to answer that. So when...
And then you think, like, whatever teacher you had growing up, like, Darren, learning Beatles songs isn't going to make you a living.
So at some point, one of the leads developed a vocal cord injury. And I ended up doing 21 shows for him.
Wow.
At the Broadhurst Theater on 44th Street.
Wow. So on your first time going on, were you feeling confident in the fact that you knew the material well enough, or were you like, holy shit, I'm on Broadway?
Well, that, you know, that happens right when curtain starts. And because you have time to think about it.
Right.
You know. But then when your cue comes and it's time for you to deliver that first line, all that goes out the window, and from that point on, you're in the moment and you're just taking it moment to moment. And of course you're running on 100% adrenaline, and your mind is firing on all cylinders, just trying to get everything right. And you don't get everything right. It's never perfect.
No.
But I was focused enough and confident enough that one of the guys on the direction team came up to me in the end of the night, hugged me, and said, "Fantastic!"
Oh, like, that's great.
I'm like, all right. Now the next night, Yoko Ono was there.
Oh, and, no pressure.
A little bit. But Don came up to me after the show and said, "Yoko," leaned in, whispered in my ear, said, "He's fantastic."
Oh,
heartwarming. I talked to her. I got to talk to her a little bit that night.
Yeah. What did you say? Like, yeah. I bet there was a lot that you'd want to say and ask, but you have like a certain amount of time, and there are manners.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, we had actually met before. We had met during rehearsals. I brought a whole bunch of reference material up into the rehearsal room, and Don and Yoko were in there, and they called me over.
Oh.
And I had this Epiphone Casino in my hands, right? And Yoko said to me, "Where did you get this book? There's pictures in here I'd never seen before." I said, "Oh, well, my mom gave it to me. So can I borrow it?" I was like, "Of course,
wow.
I'll lend it to you if you'll sign it for me."
That's awesome. And
so several weeks went by, and she had it delivered to my dressing room with on the front cover page, uh-huh, just big old drawings.
Awesome.
Imagine peace, love Yoko. And I thought, that's cool. This is a woman of her word. So I got to just kind of chat with her a little bit after the show and said, you know, my mother-in-law has a piece of paper from the Amsterdam Hilton with yours and John's doodlings on it. It's like right that night of that bed in for peace. And she said, "Wow, I don't have any of that stuff." And inside I'm like thinking, are you crazy? You have the guitars. You have the freaking Holy Grail here.
So when that ended, the show ended, it didn't do well.
No. In fact, it might have been the the only Beatles-related project that actually lost money. But for me, there was never a... it was incredible. It was magic, 100%.
Sure.
And it totally changed the way I think and the way I operate.
That's great. I remember there when you came back. I mean, we'd already had Skyrocket when you were gone there.
Right.
Even though it was K-Tool Hit Machine.
Mm-hmm. And that was the first, y'all were like the first people I wanted to see when I got home.
Yeah. Yeah, man, it was great when you came back. It took a lot of drummers to take your place.
I remember Kyle Cresham. He said, "Our worries are over. The bear is back. We got the bear." Not sure what he meant by that.
I think he meant it good, in a good way. So, when did Haunted Gardenias came out? Before then, right?
Yeah, I put out Haunted Gardenias back
2001?
In 2001. Yeah,
right. And that's available on iTunes. You can also find it on Spotify. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
no, that's excellent.
It's got a buy. Actually, I was going to ask you. You should go look at the related artists. I'd never heard of them, and there's like 12 related artists to Darren.
I'm going to do that.
Yeah, some interesting bands.
Fantastic.
So, how did you do that record?
I did that entirely with Lars Goransson.
Right.
And we recorded in several different places. I did some drums at Billy Harvey's place.
Right.
And then I would take the drums over to Lars' home studio, and we did all of the overdubs there.
Right.
I went back just the other day and listened to a bunch of work mixes, stuff that I'd taken home every day just to listen to our day's work and listen to how the vocals evolved, because I'd go in and do a different vocal take. And it was very interesting to just go back and revisit it and hear those songs being built and constructed, and then hearing them the way they appear on the album. That's a record I'm really, really proud of.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a great album. The songs are absolutely beautiful, and it sounds fantastic.
Thank you. It really does.
Yeah. So when the Lennon show finished, you didn't want to stay, like you couldn't. You had a family, and you couldn't just stay there and all of a sudden start going on auditions and working as a waiter.
Right. I really, really wanted to stay, and there were industry people that were encouraging me to stay around. But I knew that after just a few weeks, I was going to run out of money.
Yeah.
And we had a house that we couldn't get anyone. It was a time when there were refugees coming over from Katrina and Rita,
right.
The hurricanes.
Yeah.
And but we still couldn't get anyone to take our house and rent it from us. So it was either go home right away, do what you can, or go in the hole.
Right.
We came home, and shortly after that, Skyrocket started taking off.
Yeah. Did you, none of us thought that was going to actually take off as it has. And it's pretty, it's so incredibly fortuitous on the level that, I mean, we were all going to not be selling records in a year or so. You know what I mean?
Right.
On our own, or even being able to closely sustain ourselves, you know, playing. And then all of a sudden, here's this way that also, I mean, I've grown tons as a musician through it. I mean, just on all levels, you know, gleaning things from you, from everyone in the band, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has a pretty big influence on me as far as being a musician for the last decade.
Well,
or longer.
Vice versa, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's an interesting thing. I mean, like what, like when you guys first started it before me and Trish, and you guys went to go play that show at Hole in the Wall.
Oh,
what was the idea?
Oh, just totally
have
just
fun.
Having fun.
Yeah.
Just have fun and geek out on 70s guilty pleasures, and it doesn't matter if it's not perfect. It's all about the joy and the celebration of it.
Right.
And that created a spark, and I knew that we had something that we could have fun with and that we could sell. And by the time I got back from New York, that I can take the experience that I got in New York and the work ethic that I've developed in New York, and I can help shape this little hobby into a project that can do business.
Yeah.
Because the talent is all there.
Right.
Everybody in the band is just so talented, it just needs to be tied up.
Yeah.
So I think that was what I was able to contribute when I got home, is just be able to tie it together and hone certain things.
Yeah. What do you think? Because I think there are things that make us stand out, and it always is a revolving thing. Like, one, definitely, there's very strong individual personalities that are allowed to shine within the group that you don't see when you go to a wedding and a band gets up and plays.
Right.
And no offense to anyone that does that, but a lot of times you don't feel like you're at a rock show. You feel like you're at a wedding thing.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's all of our, if it's A, the attention to detail, and B, like just the fact that we've all performed so much as ourselves that we have strength in that. And when we bring that to the forefront at any given moment in the show, it makes it more special.
Mm-hmm. That's
than
what,
like a Blue Tuxedo Band, you know?
Right. That is the difference. The fact that all of us have been in the game. We've all toured. We've all fronted. We all have we know what our strengths are, and we also know that we can discover new things about ourselves. We'll discover
right.
strengths that we didn't know we had.
Right.
But it's that commitment to turning it into something that is authentic that separates that from other bands that do what we do, because we're not just up there going through the motions.
Right.
We're going up there meaning everything we do, because we know that's what you have to do.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I bet also, like, just everyone's background, it would be a completely different band had you not had, you know, theater background. Ben hadn't had that theater background.
Yeah, Ben is an incredible improviser and an amazing actor.
Yeah. So you're still acting.
Yeah.
What's the name of the web series that you were in?
Writer's Room.
Writer's Room.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on YouTube?
That's on
writersroom.com.
It's on Vimeo. It's writersroomseries.com.
Writersroomseries.com. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed what I saw of it. I think you're a good actor. Do you like doing that stuff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love it. I especially love doing this particular series because of the people that I got to know. And I found this whole new group of friends and a whole new acting community to get involved in and get to know.
Yeah.
And it's made me a much better actor since then. I was looking at a scene from Writer's Room the other day, and, you know, so many actors, they don't like to see themselves on film because they catch themselves doing certain things that they're trying to get over.
Right.
So I dread looking at a scene with me in it, but I can look at myself and I can see these faces that I make, and I can discover that is how I piss off my band and frighten my son. I so get it now.
It would probably behoove everyone to go and do some acting and be able to watch themselves do stuff.
So look at yourself, people.
Is that what I'm doing with my face?
So there's gonna
be another season of Writer's Room?
I hope so. The guy who created the show, Chris Dickerson, is definitely working on a second season, but he's got several other independent projects that he's putting together. So we're all friends, so we all see each other and say, hey, what are you up to?
Right.
How's this thing going? And some people's careers have really started to gain traction. Mine has gone much slower because I have other priorities.
Right.
Which is kind of frustrating because it makes me feel like a bad actor. But my goal is just to be as good as I can be.
Right.
And then hope that other things will come out of that.
Yeah. Have you written anything? Do you ever have any?
Written any scripts?
Yeah. A show idea or a movie idea? Or?
No, I've never dabbled into that. I've never considered myself good at writing dialogue. I'm encouraging my son to do it because he's incredibly good at making up stuff like that.
Yeah.
Dexter is enormously talented, and he's really getting in on the ground floor. He's, you know, taking improv classes and.
You know, is he liking it?
Loves it. Yeah.
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 Does he play?
He can play, but he doesn't.
Okay.
Yeah. He's a music fan. And that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got enough stuff. If he ever gets interested in playing anything, it's all there.
Yeah. Well, that was the one thing that I learned growing up in a musical family is that we were never pushed into anything in the way that who's that tennis player?
Oh, yeah, the guy that was going nuts and became like a speed freak,
Agassi. Yeah, Andre Agassi, yeah. Who had, you know, a tennis racket tied to his wrist. Yeah, you know, that never happened to us. My dad understood that in order to do it, you had to have a fever for it. And when it happens organically like that, then you just stay with it. You pick up a guitar and you don't put it down. You stay on the drums for hours.
Yeah.
So if that ever happens for my son, great. But I've been very conscious never to push that on him, because that the opposite effect takes place then. They end up hating it. I don't want anyone hating music.
No. No. Do you go on a lot of auditions? You go on some auditions. See you sometimes after auditions.
Yeah. Yeah. I go on some. The thing about auditioning is it's a job. It's one single job that you have. And then when you're done, that job is over and you move on. So I never go in expecting to hear anything else.
Right.
And sometimes I do.
Yeah.
And it's great. And then there's, you know, that job, and that job is over and you just move on. And in some ways it's like playing gigs. You know, you have this gig and this job to do, and some actually help your career, like the one we did the other night.
Yep.
Yeah, and others are just another notch on your resume.
Yeah, it's got to make some money somehow. It's funny because when in my time of acting, I just never had the passion for it. Like, I could look at it and say, I would never be excited about being cop number two in a movie. You know what I mean?
You were cop number two.
I was, but you know what? And that was fun and exciting. But I don't have the same thing as like I had getting like some shitty gig in Tulsa. Like, oh, I get to go to Tulsa. This is amazing. You know what I mean? The passion for me and being a musician is so much stronger than acting. Like, I don't know if I would be like, yes, I got this small thing and something. You know what I mean? And be as excited as I would be about something musically.
Right.
I feel like that's what made. The decision for me sort of to turn towards music.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good that you've been able to balance both.
Yeah. I would like to do better at it. But I think it's just a matter for me, it's really more about the process.
Yeah. You know,
I love being a student, and I love exploring and finding my own voice.
Right.
So that I know that the next time I get an audition for something, I'm going to have a little bit more skills in my back pocket. And even if people don't cast me, they'll remember that I was there.
Right.
Like, hey, you know, maybe we can, you know, call him in for this other thing. You know? So it's music. There's a lot more instant gratification.
Yeah.
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 And it's definitely, for me, pays a lot better.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. And are you producing anything lately? For anyone else, have you been?
Yeah. I'm just finishing up a record that I've been doing with Robert LaRoche.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's been in Patricia Vaughn's band and writing and performing with her for years. So this is the first record he's made on his own. So he's been recording at my home studio for several years, just laying down demos on acoustic and electric guitar. And he said, I've got enough stuff to make an album now. So we went laid down, put Donnie Wynn on drums and Scott Garber on bass, and I'm mixing it right now. I'm just finishing up mixing.
No, that's great. I would love to hear that. That's I like Bobby cool. a lot. Who, is there anything that you've been listening to lately that's new, that's blowing your mind? After all of this influence of music through your whole life, is there anything you've heard in, say, like the last 6 months that you're like, wow, shit, this is blowing my mind?
I really like Broken Bells.
Yeah, that's pretty beautiful stuff.
I love, I'm listening to a ton of female artists. I'm a big fan of Janelle Monáe.
Oh, yeah.
The Bird and the Bee.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you turned me on to them.
Duo out of L.A. Yeah, I like the Black Keys, of course.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I know I've heard something. Can't quit it. Oh, Mark Ronson. Big fan of Mark Ronson.
Yeah, that guy's really great.
I like everything he does.
Me too. What a great, talented guy. What McCartney record did he produce?
He produced the latest one he did called New.
Oh, right. Yeah, the one with the neon-looking thing.
Right.
Wow.
It's a good record.
Yeah, so let's tell people where they can find. They can go to darrenmusic.com, and there they can find videos. They can find the Fab Forgeries, the legendary Fab Forgeries, and then there's songs from Haunted Gardenias and from Solitarium.
Yep.
But the only one really that's out there available, like on iTunes and Spotify, is Haunted Gardenias.
Just Haunted Gardenias, yeah.
Which is a great album.
To me, that's the definitive. That's my definitive statement. That's my calling card.
Yeah. That's great. And a guy who wears a lot of hats. Skyrocket. People can find out more about what we do there at skyrocketheband.com. People that listen to show hear me talk about it all the time. I mean, I hope they kind of know what it is by now, but it is it's an experience. And this has been a great experience walking around with you on the lake.
Yeah, this has been fantastic.
Yeah. Is there anything that I'm missing?
You're a thorough man, Johnny. I think you got it covered.
Really?
Yeah.
I did it without notes. It's one of my first ones I've ever done without notes, but I figured if I don't know your story at least enough to have a conversation with you, then I'm an idiot.
That's what's so good. If I think of anything now, we're just going to come down every time we open the door.
All right. Well, thank you. I love you. I'm glad we're friends.
Be back, man.
All right. What a great time walking around the lake with Darren, having a great conversation, learning things about my dear old friend that I didn't even know in our 25 plus years of friendship. So thank you, Darren, for coming and walking around. I hope that you guys enjoyed it. I hope that the noise of walking around didn't bother you too much. I like that stuff. So it gave you a little sense of environment, right? All right, check out Darren's music at darrenmusic.com. He's a fantastic songwriter, a great musician. You can also hear those Fab Forgeries there, okay? So you can find out what that was all about. I'm going to play a little bit more music from Darren, his song Boxing Day, which was an award-winning song when he put it out on the album Haunted Gardenias, which you can find on iTunes, on Spotify, and on the internet there, all right, at Darren's website, of course, as well. So while you're out there looking up Darren's stuff, don't forget that you can like our Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and on Stitcher. So do that. You can also follow me on Instagram and on Twitter. I'm at Johnny Gowdy. Don't forget that Skyrocket, the band, which is the band that Darren and I are both in together, you can find out all about us at skyrocketheband.com. Find out if we're coming to a town near you. We play a lot in Austin. We play in Houston. We do some shows in San Antonio sometimes. And every once in a while, we play in Dallas. Okay? Thank you so much for listening. Check it out. Here's some more music from my dear friend, Darren Murphy. I had such a great time walking around with him. I hope you enjoyed it. Love you, Darren. And I love you guys, the listeners. All right? Let's get down.
Remain unsaid, but you can sense it. say, but I just wanna be. 30 weeks I've been walking through Paris streets. I could never get to sleep. I never felt like me. Anticipation in the tunnel. My cup is bare, my bank is busted, and I don't care. I belong with you. Against your breath.